It's that time, Christmas time is here. Everybody knows there's not a better time of year. Hear that sleigh, Santa's on his way. Hip hip hooray for Christmas vacation.
Hello everybody, and welcome to the Brad Kilmore Show on demand. And we have a great Christmas Eve 2020 edition of the show. It's Christmas vacation time. Listen to that. Am I the only one who loves this song? Looking good.
Got ourselves the finest snowman
in the neighborhood.
Ain't it fun?
Run.
That house done on Christmas vacation.
I mean, come on now. What a beautiful song. But welcome to the Brad Kilmore Show. This is a Christmas Eve edition of the show. And if you remember, on this show in years past, I always like to do something special around this holiday season. We've broken down the Home Alone movies before. And I thought, what a great opportunity to break down one of my favorite holiday films of all time. I put it really in a three-way tie for number one. It's Home Alone, Christmas Vacation, Home Alone 2. Those are my top three, and they're really 1A, 1B, 1C, all in a tie. And I said, man, who could I talk to about this phenomenal film, Christmas Vacation? And I said, wait, hold up. What if I talk to Jeremiah S. Chachik, the director of Christmas Vacation? So I reached out. Things were scheduled. And here we are on Christmas Eve. I'm talking to the man himself, Jeremiah Chachik, here on the Brad Kilmore Show on demand. We're talking about Christmas Vacation. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. It is the third installment in the franchise, which eventually had five entries, if you want to count the 2015's Vacation, which I don't know if we count or not, but you know, if you want to count it, that's fine. But this was the third in the series, and to me, it's the best of all the Vacation films. It's really the one that gets talked about the most. It's the one that has the best rewatchability to it, in my opinion. And the first one, Vacation, was funny. The European Vacation was funny, but this one was special. And I talked to Jeremiah Chachik, the director, about it because this has a really long and storied history, this film does. And it's a John Hughes production. John Hughes, if you're not familiar, also did Home Alone 1, 2, and 3. He did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Beethoven. The list goes on and on of all the movies that this man did. And to me, this film, which he wrote, was based off a short story. I don't know how he was able to capture this timelessness in all of his films that he has. But really, if you do a top 10 list of the 10 greatest holiday films, four of them are from him. I talked about the two Home Alones, this movie, and then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So to be able to talk to somebody who worked under John Hughes for to direct his vision for a short story that he wrote about his Christmas memories with his family and turning that into Christmas Vacation, I really jumped at the opportunity to talk to him. And Jeremiah was more than gracious with his time with us to discuss this film. I ask him everything. I ask him how he got the job, which is a incredible story. Sorry if you hear a dog barking in the background. I am home for the holidays. Incredible story how he actually got this job, how he was selected. It has to do with Budweiser and Stanley Kubrick. That's going to be my tease for you. Incredible story there. And also working with Chevy Chase, who you've heard a lot of stories about in the past. Chevy Chase may have not been the greatest person to work with. And actually, the original person attached to this project, and of course, in Hollywood, you're attached and then you're not attached. But the original person attached to direct this movie was Chris Columbus, the man who actually went on to do Home Alone 1 and 2 and Harry Potter, and just had a holiday film come out this year called The Christmas Chronicles 2 with Kurt Russell. Chris Columbus talked about how he couldn't work with Chevy Chase. It wasn't working out for him to work with Chevy. So all kinds of things were going on in this movie, the behind the scenes of the movie. So we talk about Chevy Chase. We talk about, was there ever plans for another Christmas Vacation film? Because it just killed at the box office. It was a very popular film. And talk a little bit more about what makes this film so timeless and Jeremiah's favorite scene. Also, we talk about the animated open, which is one of my favorite openings to any movie ever, the animated open to Christmas Vacation, and why he thought that was so important to put in the film. So I've talked long enough. If you're listening to me for the first time, go over and follow me on Twitter at Brad Gilmore. Check out everything I do, Back to the Future, the podcast. Check out the Hall of Fame with Booker T and myself. Check out the movie trivia Schmodown stuff I do with the Schmodown Rundown and coming up next with Frank Janish and Jennifer Sturger. But if you're not here for any of that, you're just here to listen to Jeremiah talk about Christmas Vacation here on Christmas Eve, man, look, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's get into it right now.
Oh, my God. You're my dreamboat for sure.
Can I get a Great Scott?
Great Scott.
Oh, all right. Here's Jeremiah Chaychick.
So fantastic.
On the Brad Gilmore Show on demand.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
And he joins me now. Jeremiah, how you doing today?
I'm as well as can be expected under these circumstances, but okay.
Yeah, it's definitely a different time for everybody. It's a different holiday season. Are you a big holiday guy? Do you get into the festivities typically?
We do. We, you know, yearly host a Christmas party here. We are very social and we cook a lot. And this year, not so much. You know, you don't want to be the last person that gets COVID.
You don't. We're right here at the finish line. You know what I mean? We're right here.
I think hopefully, we're far, but
hopefully.
Hold on, yeah.
Hopefully. So, yeah, you don't want to be that guy. What is though, even under these circumstances, but under normal holiday seasons, like what's your big go-to thing? Do you have a certain tradition that you like?
Normally we host a Christmas party on Christmas Day. So when everybody's done with presents, family, and that kind of chaos, they come over here, they eat more, they drink more, and we have a good time. So, and we also have our party for our kind of so-called orphans, you know, people whose parents may be far away. And anyway, so we've been doing this for many years, and this year will be a little different.
Yeah, obviously it's, you know, like we said before, not the normal circumstances, but we're excited to talk to you today because not only were the holiday season, a lot of great holiday cinema always happening, and you've directed one of the most classic holiday film of all time, in my opinion. And I want to talk to you about that, but first, I want to kind of get into a little bit of your career prior to that. I know that you've been in film and directing. I think you did some music videos back in the day, if I have that right. Tell me a little bit about your background, Jeremiah.
I began as a photographer. Effectively, I was an artist. I was living in Toronto at the time, and I'd started a gallery with some friends and was really focused on printmaking and photography. Had several shows. One of the shows that I had done, a solo show, was quite popular. And one of the people who came to it was a big wing at McCann Erickson. And he said, "Hey, you want to do a picture for us for some wine or some booze?" Of course, you had me at booze, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, and they paid me as much as they made the whole year before. And so, through that, I started to get more work as a commercial photographer. And one of the gigs that I got was a fashion gig, which I kind of dove into. And before long, I was a kind of bona fide fashion photographer working in Milan for Italian Vogue, where I did many years of that and back and forth from New York, where I had moved. And in New York, I obviously was doing commercial photography and then was kind of scouted for a commercial director's career. And that was fun. Since when I was at university, I went to McGill University in Montreal and studied theater. So it wasn't, you know, the dramaturgy of it all was not very, you know, difficult for me to kind of plunge into. And of course, the photography and the framing and visual kind of iconography were kind of second nature to me. I had to learn how to edit. And I remember my very first commercial where I shot like 50 takes of a girl drinking a glass of wine. Then I got into the cutting room and it was like, yeah, take one looks really good. I always use this on film sets. I go, okay, print one in 50. But through that, I had a kind of a nice, strong kind of international career directing commercials. And then that led to an awareness in Hollywood of my potential, I guess they saw it. And through that, I started to direct. And Christmas Vacation was my first.
Well, so did you ever have any inclination when you were at university? I know you're a photographer, but did you ever want to get into, you know, features and any sort of film? Or was it just, hey, you know, I like doing my photography, and then this is something that just kind of came about like you described?
No, it wasn't that. You know, I was one of those kids who's like, yeah, my dad gave me this Super 8 camera and I made like my version of Star Wars when I was 8. And no, it wasn't like that for me. You know, being a polite Canadian with, at that time, no industry to speak of, I couldn't ever imagine how one would break into it, though I did inquire. I tried to push into the National Film Board, which was the operative kind of entry at that point. Also, I studied with John Grierson, who, those of us who want to Google him, he's the man who he started the British Film Institute, I think it was, and coined the word documentary. And he was, you know, was in his 80s, and he had taught a large class. And I was lucky enough to be his assistant in the final years of his life. And he did small amounts of kind of a, you know, group, couple of classes with seven of us in. And that was very inspiring because he had screened a lot of the classic documentaries. And he produced documentaries, Night Train and, Mail Train, I think one very, very famous one, Nanook of the North, those, you know, he knew Leni Riefenstahl and Charlie Chaplin. It was an amazing character. Wow. And so he really did whet my appetite for filmmaking in general. But I didn't have a kind of a strong way into the industry. Of course, you know, when I got to the U.S., it was, you know, as one would imagine, there was a lot of opportunities here if one would kind of focus and do it.
But for me, like, To hear your story, it's actually really awesome, because I try to think of earlier this year, I published my first book, right? I made the pitch and they said, hey, you got the job, you can write this book. I was like, man, this is awesome. This is a great opportunity. How do you write a book? Like, I'm not 100% sure on how to do this, right? And I had to really figure my way out through it and make many mistakes and spend many nights typing away at a keyboard with pages that were never going to be seen. And a lot of it was trial and error. For you, when you, and I want to get to the movie itself, but when you got the, let me ask you this. How did you get on it? I know you said you got on people's radars, but did you have to make a pitch and saying, this is my, you know, vision, for lack of a better term, for this film? And then when you got it, were you like, what do I do now?
It was, you know, very different than that experience. I you know, I was doing a lot of commercials at that time, and I was flying, I think, from London to New York, or New York to London. I was reading the New York Times, and I had read this article. It was an interview with Stanley Kubrick, and it was on American filmmaking and on his new film that he was promoting. And he had mentioned in the article that when asked about American filmmaking, he said, oh, my favorite American filmmaking is like these Budweiser commercials that I get on these tapes that they send me when I watch football, because he was a big football fan. They used to send him VHS tapes to London. And I was reading this and I went like, oh, geez, those are my commercials. I made those commercials. Oh my God. It didn't take long. After that, I got a call from, you know, the call, you know, please hold for Steven Spielberg. And you go like, oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Sure. Anyway, they brought me in, Kathy Kennedy, Steven Spielberg, Frank Marshall. They brought me into the office there at Amblin. And I was thrilled just to meet. And they, you know, Steven said that, you know, when they'd asked people about commercials, your name had come up frequently. And they had an idea to do a movie about the Apollo Theater in New York, Amateur Night in particular. I had just really moved from New York to LA. I said to myself, I should have come earlier. This is how it is here. Would I be interested in developing a sort of an interesting musical format based on the Amateur Night at the Apollo? And it was before the advent of the commercialization of the Apollo on TV, et cetera. So it was still pretty focused on the neighborhood, et cetera. Of course, now I think like, oh, who would ask a white guy to do that? It's ridiculous. But at then we weren't so PC, and I jumped at the chance and developed this movie. And it was I wanted to do a small movie for Amblin. Didn't want to spend a lot of dough, wanted control over it. I got myself a great team with the help of Steven and some of the cinematographers and crew people who I had worked with a lot over the years in commercials. And I remember the head of the studio at that time, it was Warner's, asking me when I kind of turned in the script, well, this is a small movie. We should make a big movie with movie stars here. And the problem is it was about unknowns, and a lot of the drama was about, would they make it or not? And
right.
In my story, some did, even though they were very talented, and some didn't. You could never tell if somebody had talent, was on stage, they could be booed off or they could be applauded, whatever. I had made commercials with Whitney Houston, and, you know, they said, you can get her. And, you know, anyway, I didn't want to do that. They said, well, we're going to develop it anyway. They went ahead and they did develop it. It didn't turn out very well. And by that time, the Apollo had become commercial anyway. It evolved a very strong relationship between me and Warner Brothers with the execs there. And I guess they thought, well, I guess this guy should direct a movie for us. At the time, I was thinking, oh, they just didn't want to hurt my feelings, so they're sending me scripts. Of course, little did I know about Hollywood. They don't care about my feelings. Anyway, so they had sent me a bunch of scripts, one after the other. I wasn't crazy about them. In fact, I remember they had sent me one, and they said, oh, you know, Clint Eastwood is going to do this. We'd love you to read it and think about it. I said, there's no way that Clint Eastwood is going to make a movie called Pink Cadillac. I'm like, not going to happen. It's so silly. Of course, you know, they were sending me their slate. But one of the scripts that finally arrived was John Hughes's script of Christmas Vacation, and I read it. I'd never done any comedy. My work was always kind of long lens, kind of moody, fast cut, kind of the opposite. And I just took a shot and said, yeah, I'll do it. It's so funny. This script is so good. And lo and behold, they gave it to me.
Well, that's an incredible story. I love the Kubrick talking about you in an interview while you're reading it on the plane to London. That's like a once in a million story. That's incredible.
Yeah, believe me.
Yeah, I'm sure that you know better than I, but just hearing that, being the guy that happened to direct those Budweiser commercials from one of the greatest directors of all time, Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, yeah. And later, you know, I did get a chance to meet him.
Oh, you did? How did that go?
Yeah. Oh, it was great because we were both shooting. I was shooting at Pinewood, so was he when he was doing Eyes Wide Shut. And I had known his AD. I knew Nicole. I had met Tom. There was a very, very tiny crew. And so it was very late at night. I had wrapped, and the AD said, oh, yeah, why don't you come over? You know, it was a very close set. I just had to walk across the the lot and just spent some time there on that beautiful New York set. It was fabulous.
Oh, that's incredible. That's incredible. But so you read this John Hughes script. Obviously, John Hughes at that time was on a great run and would continue to be on a great run into the late 90s of writing and producing and directing iconic films. But the Vacation series was already an established comedy vehicle for Chevy Chase. They had the two prior to Christmas Vacation. Was that intimidating for you at all, especially for your first feature? Oh, I'm going to direct a sequel of an already popular franchise.
Well, it was for me personally. You know, it gave me pause even to accept the gig at all. You know, feeling, I don't want to make a sequel, for God's sake. But there's a couple of interesting. First of all, I knew because John had tipped me that he had written this as a short story for the Lampoon, where he was writing, you know, a while ago, called Christmas 59. Mm-hmm. So it was a standalone idea of a man who wanted to do well by his family, and in so doing, almost destroys his family. And so it's a great idea for a film, and John's script was fantastic in terms of how he adapted his own screenplay. I just made a decision that I was going to do my own unique movie, that I would not watch the first two at all. I hadn't seen them, and I still haven't seen them.
Really? Wow.
I guess it's just a conceit now, but I hadn't, because I really didn't want it to influence my thinking about the movie. I just wanted to do whatever movie I had in my head. So on the technical end, I was not intimidated. I had already evolved a relationship with the studio. A lot of my team were familiar to me through commercials and all the rest of it. And casting was nothing short of like a blast. Outside of, you know, I was got to work with Chevy and Beverly, but Randy also. But I got to cast the kids, Johnny Galecki. I just made him a star.
Look at you.
That's a joke for those who can't see my face. But all of them had great talent. I surrounded myself with great classical actors, you know, Diane Ladd, E.G. Marshall, John Randolph, Bill Hickey, May Castell, Betty Boop, who is Betty Boop, for God's sakes,
right,
for those who are interested in the history of cinema. I felt very, very profoundly supported and profoundly safe in the environment, despite the difficulties of shooting. John had gone, he was on set for a few days early and then went back to Chicago to direct, I think it was Uncle Buck, I think, if memory serves me well. And so I was left on my own to kind of sink or swim. I had really good production team. And I was shooting on the back lot and in these kind of amazing studios that, you know, had housed some of my most films that influenced me over the years. So I was just trying to enjoy every single moment of it. And I did. The difficult moments.
Yeah, and I'm sure there were ups and downs throughout the process. You know, historically, And I'm always speaking from an observer's standpoint because I've never had the one-on-one interaction. But depending on who you speak to, Chevy Chase can either be the greatest actor you ever work with or he can be a little bit difficult at times. What was your experience like with Chevy? Because I feel out of all the Vacation films, and I know you haven't seen them all, but I have, I feel like this one, he came off the most likable but also the funniest that he was in any of them. So how was he working with on set?
Well, since he wanted me to direct it, he was incredibly malleable and responsive. He has great comic instincts.
Second to none, really.
That way. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was good. In terms of how that kind of experience plays out, you know, I always came to the set as a director, so I am not intimidated by potential difficult actors. I treat every actor the same. I will depending on how much responsibility they have on the movie, I will give them a huge amount of support. My job is to make them feel safe and energized in terms of what their ability to bring the best of their work to the set. And I got a reputation for working with difficult actors, Sharon Stone, Sean Connery. I mean, I have worked with people who have tremendous focused egos, trust me. But, so do I. So if I lose control of the set, I feel I can't direct it. So I'm never intimidated by that. It's not my way or the highway. That's not really what I'm saying. But I do want to provide a very clear and concise direction to my decision making, and any note that I give is not coming from a place of ego. It's not coming from a place of, my way or the highway. It really is about how can we explore this moment, this gag, this joke, this emotion, to make it brighter, better, harder, subtler, whatever that is. So it's more like I'm jamming with jazz players or conducting an orchestra. I'm just there as a roadmap, but I want my roadmap to be as clear as possible.
Okay, so it sounds like when you say you're like a jazz player in some regard, did you allow for a lot of improvisation on the set? I feel like with comedies, you almost have to allow the actors to feel it out a little bit. Were you okay with improvisation during the film?
Yeah, in fact, I happen to love improv, but it's got to be based on a kind of a clear screenplay. So again, I had the benefit of a John Hughes screenplay that was phenomenal. We would come, we would read through the scene, we would rehearse it, I would block it, and then we would shoot it. Once I had it in the can, that I was going like, that's great. Then it was like, okay, go nuts, be there. That little moment that you had, run with that moment. And so, yeah, we did that.
Yeah, I feel like you almost have to allow for the comedy to breathe and to feel the ebb and flow of it, especially sure. With a comedy. With a drama, mm-hmm. It's a little bit more rigid.
It's more controlled. It's a lot tighter, yeah.
Yeah, and the lines are written with specific intent to further the story, yeah. Whereas comedy, it's more the scene being set for the jokes, if you follow what I'm saying.
Well, yes, in this particular film, I had become quite obsessed, if you will, with landing the emotion of it and landing the heartfelt moments. John was very, very good about creating sort of the American sentimentality moments, which I think are good in a Christmas movie. That tugging of the heartstrings, and so I really focused a lot of my attention and detail and nuance on those moments, because I knew if I knew the movie was going to play funny, but if people didn't care, the only thing they would ask themselves after it ended was, what do you feel like, Indian or Chinese? Let's go have some dinner, rather than like, wow, that was that was an experience. And so that became a lot of my method.
And you know what? That definitely comes through. It definitely comes through. And the fact that you said that makes me really now look back at all the vacation movies and figure out, why is this the one that the most people talk about? And it is the only story where it's grounded in this sense of sentimentality around the holidays. True. But as you described earlier, a guy who really wants this Christmas to be great, but ends up ruining it all for his family. And there's something so relatable about that. Everybody wants their gift to be the best, and they want to put the smile on the face. But then when you open up that gift on Christmas Day and you get a new pair of socks, you might be somewhat deflated, but you still appreciate the effort at times. And I think that was what Clark Griswold really was. It was the effort that everybody appreciated, although the follow-through might not have been the best. Was that an accurate description?
Well, yes, and I think it goes beyond Christmas. I mean, sometimes we have this kind of innate desire to do something that is so so brightly burning within that we lose sight of its impact as we kind of buzzsaw through the obstacles in order to achieve it. You know, there may be bodies lying all over the place in terms of pain we cause, irresponsibility. There's all kinds of ways that we can look back on our behaviors for good reason. In other words, it's often like doing bad things for good reason. And that's always a moral judgment, you know, and, you know, obviously plays very well at Christmas.
Is there a particular scene or anything? There's a few aspects about the movie I want to ask you about specifically, but is there a particular scene that you're most proud of? You know, when I was talking about my book, there's a particular chapter that I really love, and I always tell everybody, oh, this was my favorite chapter. Was there a particular scene that you really loved doing, and when you look back now, you're like, God, that really had everything that I wanted?
There is, I mean, there's a few things that I really like, and I don't, you know, I haven't watched the movie a lot. So, I mean, that's, you know, when it's done.
I understand. Yeah.
But there's a scene where, Chevy, who's already demonstrated, his, kind of obsession with putting as many lights on the house as possible and working all that magic and et cetera, et cetera. Family's gathered outside, everyone's waiting. Drum roll. I remember, drum roll, please. I think that was improv. But when he throws those pieces of wire together and plugs it in and nothing happens, the audience, and I go back to the very first preview screening where I was ashen for fear that my career was completely over by the time this movie would stop playing. And I was sitting next to Terry Semel, who was running the studio. And at that moment, when those plugs came together, no lights came on, the entire audience went, oh. They just sighed collectively. And I didn't expect that. I expected that people would feel, oh God, he fucked up again. Mm-hmm. But they expressed it as a collective theater. And at that point, I knew that that movie would be successful because I knew that the audience was with him, despite how cartoony and crazy and broad the comedy was. They were with him emotionally at that moment. And I remember Terry Semel turned to me and nodded, and I turned to him, and it was like, oh, maybe I'll get to direct again.
maybe.
So there's definitely that. And of course the cat.
Oh yeah. The cat moment is great, but honestly, whenever, you know, everything kind of explodes at the end with the Cousin Eddie's chemical waste or what have you. And then, the grandmother starts singing the national anthem is one of those scenes that always makes me laugh so hard. And then the fact that everyone goes with it, everyone decides to go with it, you know, okay, well, you know what, let's just go with crazy grandma in this moment. Let's sing the national anthem. It's just, that was great. It was great. Then the other thing you mentioned the animatedness of the character, where did the idea for the opening credits come from? Because not only is that song great, that opening credit scene is so good, and it's something that isn't seen in movies at all today anymore. Any sort of opening credits, you're almost right after the movie starts, you're in the thrust of it. But that was a great opening.
You know, I've never been asked that question before, and there's a really, I think, very funny story attached to it. I always wanted 2D animated credits over the film. And I did for a very specific reason, because I wanted the audience to before they even hit the road in that first shot, I wanted them to know that they're watching a cartoon. Like, in other words, if for any reason people thought they were watching something dramatic, I wanted them to give themselves permission to watch something silly. Or based on something, but not reality. So I really wanted that. So I asked the studio, I said, you know, I have this idea. I want to do some animations. Here's some samples that I want. There's a company that I think would do a good job. And I remember the response was like, are you out of your mind? You know how much that costs? That's a lot of money to do an animated title baked in, you know, all of that. They said, no, you know, you give us something else. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to give you something else. All right. So I went away and I made a opening title sequence that could not have been cheaper. It looked very much like a French art film of the 60s. It was 1:3:3, almost square in format. It was black with a lot of dust and scratches. The white titles were shaking, like projector flop. And all the titles were in French. They were like, so it looked like a French art film. The music that I chose was Santa Claus is Coming to Town, sung by an ancient Jamaican in heavy patois. And I put that together and I said, and by the way, I fell in love with these titles because I thought, you know, with all their advertising and all of that, you sit in the theater and all of a sudden what looks like a French art film is now playing before it goes wide. With that music, you can hardly understand the lyrics of the song. I showed it to Warner Brothers and they were like, when can you get started on that animated
So you almost tricked them into getting what you wanted. They're like, this guy's crazy.
I would have gone in either direction. I did. But I'll save that for another movie, maybe.
But you're right. That opening title scene, and now that you say that about you wanted to get people in the mindset of this is a zaniness, there's a zaniness to this film that's not grounded in your normal reality, it makes perfect sense. And I think that that's such a unique choice that to this day, until you said that, I never understood why it was there. I just always loved it. And now it makes sense within the format of the film. I mean, even at the very beginning when they're driving to get the Christmas tree and he's under the 18 wheeler, that's a very cartoony like thing. And then the big tree on the small car, these are very cartoony elements. And we're just coming out of an animation. This is great.
And by the way, and you counterpoint that with that beautiful song by Mavis Staples. You know what I mean? I think Prince was involved in producing it, as I remember Gary Marsh, who was the head of music at Warner's, had put us all together. I think she did an amazing job.
And then you talked about the brilliance of the cast, not only Beverly D'Angelo, Chevy Chase, you named several great actors who are in it, but Julia Louis-Dreyfus played a really great role in that movie. This was really before Seinfeld took off, and she was great. What was, in your mind, the purpose of those two characters? In your mind, because I've read like internet Reddit streams of what people actually thought that they were supposed to be. But in your mind, you're the director. What was the purpose of the character of those two characters?
Well, I like the fact that they were as opposite to the Griswold family as you could get. You know, it really didn't matter which individual you chose or which part of the family and which dynamic. This was a, you know, remember when people was like, oh, yuppies. Remember that?
Yuppies? Mm-hmm.
They were yuppies in that derogatory, vernacular. And so there was a joke about how unrelaxed they were about Christmas. So they were the humbug of it all. If there had to be a humbug, they were the humbug. And I mean, I thought they were great. Of course, you know, Julia, she was brilliant then. She was brilliant now. She is brilliant now. What can I say?
Yeah, I've said about Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she might be the most talented comedian maybe ever. She's definitely up on the Mount Rushmore, in my opinion, just the comedic work that she's been able to do and continue to do in different varieties of formats. Always.
Yeah, I mean, I became aware of her on from Saturday Night Live. She was there for a few years, and that's why I cast her.
Oh, you cast her directly from Saturday Night Live. Okay, awesome. Yeah,
I don't remember if she had left the show or not, but she was like, it was just like, let's get her to do this. This is perfect.
Yeah, she was an obvious megastar in the, you know, the precipice of megastardom. And when the film came out, like you said, and you saw test screenings, but it essentially, did you think that it was going to enter that lexicon of Christmas movies? Because now it's you know, your film, Christmas Vacation, Home Alone, A Christmas Story, there's a few others that are staples. I mean, I pass a billboard every day on the freeway that says it's a billboard for an energy company that says, you know, decorate like a Griswold, pay like a Scrooge, you know. So it's in the public consciousness. This is a thing that everybody is aware of and references. Did you have any inclination upon release that that was a possibility or even a probability?
It's a complicated answer. I mean, obviously not.
Right.
You know, how many movies kind of enter that particular path that becomes perennial, where multi-generations know the language of it, et cetera. And I can't even take ownership of it, even though I directed it and somewhat responsible for the movie. Once the movie is done, you kind of give it to the world. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with timing and the very specific way it kind of just fits through a crack in the culture. But the one thing that I have to say, and I've said this before in interviews, my style of filmmaking as a commercial director before I made that movie was extraordinarily focused on a certain visual vernacular that one would consider more hip at the time. And, you know, I described it as having longer lenses, faster cutting, monochrome lighting, you know, that kind of vibe. When I did that movie, you know, I made a conscious choice to use very different kind of lensing, very different kinds of lighting for me, more open, broader lighting. Slow down the pace of cutting. And make decisions based on hair, makeup, wardrobe, soundtrack, blocking, etc., that would have a timeless quality for the story. And it wasn't because I thought, oh, if I do this, then, you know, in 30 years, people are still going to enjoy the movie. No, I did it because the movie itself felt classic in and of itself from the screenplay. That it was universal, that you could have made this movie in the 30s, you could make it again today. You know, some of the technology and the lighting would be different, some of the ways we approach it would be different, but the essence of it would be the same. And I wanted very much not to make the movie of the moment way back in 1989, but something that had no age to it, that you wouldn't really know when it was made. You know, I tried the same thing on Benny and June, which was my next film. And to that extent, you know, because some films, you really want to drive the kind of now, that hip quotient, that, you know, that kind of kinetic experience that is just, you know, full of wow. This one, I did not, I consciously set out not to do that. So I think that its kind of more classic aesthetic writ large contributed to its universality over the years. But again, I think there's a lot of luck involved. There's a lot of who looked at that movie when it first came out and what did it say to them that they wanted to show their kids. And then again, I mean, I brought my 7-year-old, she was 6, last year, granddaughter, when they re-released the movie. And we went to Universal, you know, City Walk, into a theater, paid and bought tickets. and sat there, and it was, for me, just the most tremendous experience, especially in a full theater. It was so fun. It was one of the first times I ever really got to see the movie objectively, or somewhat objectively, and, you know, I thought it was pretty funny.
I think it's a little bit more than pretty funny. A couple more questions for you, and then you've been so generous with your time. In regards to its almost immediate success, and then its ability to enter into the pop culture lexicon and be one of the go-to movies, and I know there was a, you know, Vegas Vacation, then there was something with Cousin Eddie, but it seems like out of all the vacation movies, this one seemed the most obvious to do a direct sequel to. Because when you think about the other John Hughes property in the vein of Christmas, you think of Home Alone. There was Home Alone 2 and then subsequently Home Alone 3. I feel like The Christmas Vacation was needed of a direct sequel. Was there ever any discussion of that?
No. I think part of it is you need John Hughes to write it if you're going to capture that. I mean, there are plenty of writers today who are incredibly talented who could write it. But also, you know, there's a cynicism of it about making a sequel on something like that. Like, why? I think you want to make a sequel on movies that can be improved. You know, I always think that when you look at Alien and Aliens, I mean, both are fantastic. You can't say, you know, Alien was better than Aliens. No, I mean, they're both phenomenal movie. Can we say that, you know, Fast 8 is better than Fast and the Furious 1? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's bigger, you know. There's got to be a reason for it. And if there's no good reason for it, then it becomes commercial. And I think people smell the authenticity of things nowadays more than ever. We're on the verge of seeing Wonder Woman 84. I watched Wonder Woman. I thought it was really great. I am so looking forward to Wonder Woman 84 just because of the way, first of all, I think Patty Jenkins is a fantastic director. And number two, I do think that when you twist it a bit, make a prequel, reset it in an age and are able to capture the music and the hairstyles and the wardrobe and whatnot to freshen it up, even in a kind of retro way, it becomes really, really fun. And so, you know, I think there's a Christmas Vacation maybe set in the 20s, you know, with gangsters, right? What would Al Capone do? I don't know.
It would be an interesting prospect. And Jeremiah, you've been so generous with your time, but I want to ask you about your podcast. You said that you have a podcast. You have a lovely little setup over there that we were discussing prior to rolling. Tell the people about your podcast and how they can get in contact with you.
We do a podcast called The Future of Photography. It's there's four of us. We're on different continents. We all bring different approaches to our image making, and you can find us at your podcast dealer anywhere. Future of Photography. We do it once a week, and it's a lot of fun. And you know, it really speaks more to my career as an artist, separate than me as a filmmaker, writer, director, TV maker, whatever I'm happen to be doing, especially this year where, you know, we are kind of homebound a lot. And so there's that.
Awesome. Well, yeah, well, it's definitely. And then are you on any social sites where the people can check you out, or are you just doing the podcast?
No, I do. Instagram is my kind of go-to because of my photography, and it's Jeremiah_Chechik. That's it.
You know, all right. Well, Jeremiah,
for those of you who can spell,
right? I'm sure they'll find it one way or another, and we'll put a link out there. And
my feeling is, if you can't, then you really didn't want to go that bad. Anyway, thank you for the interview, and I find it funny that ESPN is doing it. You know, I thought, oh yeah, they'll ask me about the 77 Yankees and Bronx is Burning, right?
Well, you know, we're big pop culture fans over here at ESPN, and of course,
don't I know it?
This is a massive pop culture film, one of the classics. Do you rank it as the best Christmas movie? I know it's a little hard for you to maybe make that assumption, but is it up there for you, objectively speaking?
My favorite. You want to know my favorite Christmas movie? Bad Santa.
That's a great one. That's a great one. Which, by the way, its subsequent sequel, not as great. That is one I can say the sequel wasn't as great as the first one.
Yeah, I did not see the sequel because I didn't want to harm my experience of the first one, which because I had heard it's nothing good. But, oh my God, Bad Santa.
That's a winner. Jeremiah says it's a winner. Well, Jeremiah, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Good luck with the show.
Oh, Brian, what have you done now?